I'm not only honored to be here, but I'm absolutely thrilled.
A big honor for an Anchorage Assembly member at the White House. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, grocery stores in Anchorage work toward reducing food waste by donating to needy Alaskans.
That banana has traveled a long way by the time that it gets to Alaska, and at times you will find product we're not going to be able to sell our way out of.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Alaska Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case that could upend the way the state pays for education. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough is arguing that it's a violation of the state constitution to require local governments to chip in money to fund local schools, particularly when there are small communities throughout rural Alaska that aren't required to provide any local contributions. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes was in court today and says the legal dispute hovers over what counts as a dedicated fund. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Lori.
So, Zach, why does the Ketchikan Gateway Borough say that the state's mandatory minimum funding requirements are unconstitutional?
So to get what the borough is getting at, you've got to go back to what dedicated funds mean in Alaska. And that's sort of a holdover from when the territorial laws crossed over into the constitution that we now have. That was in the 50s and 60s, and there were these consultants brought in to kind of help design the state constitution. And one of the things they were worried about were dedicated funds that states like New Jersey would put towards highways and some other stuff like that. And basically, it ended up giving small bureaucracies a lot of control in ways that legislators didn't really want to have happen. So there's this big thing in Alaska. Anyone who's familiar with local government has heard complaints about you're not able to dedicate funds, you're not able to earmark funds. Everything just has to go into the same general fund when it comes to state money. Now, what the borough is saying is that by asking local governments, like the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, to fund education at a minimum level, that amounts to a dedicated fund, right? It's an indirect dedicated fund. That the argument that the borough is making is that the legislature has kind of squeaked its way in to being able to guide funds towards education in a way that's unconstitutional.
Both sides are citing different legal precedents, but the state's argument to the Supreme Court says local contributions are not a dedicated fund, that in fact, they've long been a way to promote local buy-in. What case is the state making there?
The case that the state's making, and you're right to say that there's a lot of different precedents flying back. I am not a legal scholar, so keeping track of all the different moving parts on this has been a challenge in its own right. If I understand the state's case correctly, what they're saying is, look, this isn't a dedicated fund. In fact, most of the boroughs and local governments, including the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, fund education above the mandatory minimums required by the state. Ketchikan's required to pay about $4 million in their local contribution. The year under dispute in this case, they paid $7 million, which means they raised their own minimum numbers because they think that education is that important. It's beyond the minimum. The state is saying not only do they feel that way, most feel that way, and we have a great system in Alaska that requires local buy-in. Right, local governments and the communities therein have to decide, not only what's the minimum, but what do we want to have? And instead of it just being a state school, the community has some say and some leeway in determining program. The case that they're an example that the state's attorney, Kate Vogel, brought up was the case of the North Slope Borough, where there's an Inupiaq curriculum that's taught there. It's overseen by the state, but it's done in accordance. And that's kind of one of those ways that by asking for local governments to be a partner, to pony up funds, they're actually making sure that there's some presence and some commitment from the local communities.
So, Zach, what's at stake in this ruling? It could be anywhere from a few months to 2 years before the justices give a ruling. What are the implications of this decision?
Lori, The short answer is we don't really know. And I hate offering that, but it's in this case, it's a really, really, really good and important answer that I heard from a lot of people that are watching this case really closely. Basically, this is the way the state has funded its education system in one way or another with some modifications since Alaska was a state. If the Ketchikan Gateway Borough wins this case, it'll mean we have to completely redesign how the state pays for education. And instead of there being any one outcome that anyone knows will happen, you know, the state will just step in and fill in the gap that remains. This has such broad implications that it's likely it would go before the legislature to redesign the system as it stands. For some people, particularly those watching rural schools, that's a dicey proposition because the state is kind of broke. But the short answer is, we really don't know. This is a huge case with some really big implications for years to come across the state.
All right, Zach, thanks for covering the case for us, and thanks for the update.
Thank you, Lori.
That was KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reporting. Testimony on an anti-discrimination measure in the Anchorage Assembly stretched on for hours last night with no final vote. Assembly members are discussing an ordinance extending legal protections to residents on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. Arguments touched on religious freedoms, personal experiences, and the status of equal rights in Anchorage, with more than 100 residents signed up to testify.
Discrimination is not a Christian value.
In the beginning, it said Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, not Adam and his preference.
The faith-based community asked for fair and equitable treatment as well.
In 2009, I was evicted from my home for being transgender.
In 2012, a ballot measure addressing the same issue was rejected in a citywide vote. But observers say that process had flaws and that regardless, public perceptions have shifted decisively since then. Assemblymember Bill Evans, a fiscal conservative from South Anchorage, introduced the original draft of the ordinance. He says he's seen through work as a labor lawyer that a need exists to extend legal protection to more Anchorage residents.
I think attitudes about this issue in general have changed dramatically, even in the last 5 years. And I think, just the acceptance of people of different sexual orientations in society has moved along. And I think attitudes have changed, changed in the public and changed on members of the assembly. Overall, I think the majority of people basically want to live and let live.
Many advocating for and against AO96 remember a similar battle before the assembly in 2009, nicknamed the Summer of Hate by many in Anchorage. This time they say the tone is more tempered, with less anger and acrimony. In 2009, groups staged protests and counter-protests outside assembly chambers, with Bible camp students from the Matsu Valley bussed in to influence the debate. On Tuesday, testimony was orderly, if sometimes unconventional and impassioned. Another difference is expanded support from the business community. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, an influential business group, didn't take a stand on the issue last time. Now, CEO Bill Popp says the anti-discrimination measure makes good economic sense.
We believe that this is good for business because it creates a welcoming environment as a community goes, which is a key element in attracting and retaining workforce and business investment.
Public testimony continues this evening in Anchorage ahead of assembly deliberations and minor amendments. Both sides expect the issue to pass the assembly, with opponents hinting they may bring the issue back to a ballot initiative. Anchorage Assemblymember L.V. Gray Jackson missed last night's assembly meeting. That's because today she was at the White House introducing Michelle Obama at an event highlighting the First Lady's Let's Move initiative to combat childhood obesity. Anchorage was one of 63 communities nationwide being honored by the First Lady for meeting goals like posting a healthy food guide at city buildings with food service and offering school meal programs. And for Gray Jackson, the honor was up close and personal. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
It's almost like the White House has a crush on Alaska. First, President Barack Obama visits and gushes in social media about what a great time he had. And then, of the dozens of cities honored in the Let's Move event at the White House, the person organizers chose to introduce the First Lady, Anchorage Assemblywoman and Vice Chair L.V. Gray Jackson.
I'm not only honored to be here, but I'm absolutely thrilled.
Gray Jackson, in a three-minute speech to about 150 attendees, called Mrs. Obama an inspiration and a fierce and relentless advocate for children.
It is my great honor and privilege to present to you First Lady Michelle Obama.
The First Lady thanked Gray Jackson by name, and then Mrs. Obama essentially spread some love to the whole 49th state.
And thank you for hosting my husband. He has talked about his visit endlessly. He says we're going back, so I hope that me and the girls will come and visit. I hope so. But thank you for all that you're doing.
It was so awesome. It was so awesome. I just admire that woman.
Gray Jackson said afterward she hated that she had to miss an Anchorage Assembly meeting to travel to the White House, but it was so worth it. Gray Jackson says she and the First Lady had about 10 minutes together backstage.
She's got charisma. She is unique. You know, I've got pretty nice-looking arms, too, and we're both just about the same height. And she looked at me and said, oh, look at your arms, and we did an arm pose.
Gray Jackson says she doesn't know why she was chosen to give the intro, but she says if the Obamas do take an Alaska vacation, she's already offered to show them around. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a floating city visits Unalaska for the first time.
We've done the best we can. We've kind of been sounding the alarm, so to speak, for at least a year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
The Legislative Council is moving forward with their lawsuit to stop Medicaid expansion. In the meantime, both the legislature and the Walker administration are working with consultants to find ways to reduce the cost of the Medicaid program. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Lawyers for the Legislative Council are considering filing a motion in Superior Court in the next few weeks that would kick off the next phase of the case. In late August, Superior Court Judge Frank Fifner ruled against a preliminary injunction that would have blocked Medicaid expansion from starting on September 1st. In that preliminary decision, he said the Legislative Council failed to prove it was likely to win on the merits if the case moved forward. But Senate Majority Leader John Coghill still thinks the legislature has a strong case against the governor.
Does the governor have the authority to get the state entangled in things that the legislature by law is supposed to appropriate for? I think we got to get the answer to it. This just brings that question up very clearly in my mind.
The case hinges on whether the Medicaid expansion population is an optional or required group under federal law. The governor needs legislative approval to add an optional group to the program. Coghill knows a final decision in court won't come quickly, possibly not until after next year's legislative session. He thinks there's support for continuing Medicaid expansion in the legislature, but he says that support hinges on another issue that will be front and center during the legislative session, Medicaid reform.
And my expectation is the reforms are very important because a regular Medicaid population payment system right now is just not sustainable to our budget, and it's not sustainable in its growth pattern.
This month, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approved hiring a consulting firm to study Medicaid expansion and reform. And Coghill says he sees the lawsuit as a way to put pressure on the governor to work with the legislature to bring down the cost of the state's Medicaid program. Governor Walker included several cost-cutting reforms in the Medicaid expansion bill he introduced last session, and the state's health department is working with a consultant to look for other ways to reduce Medicaid costs and streamline services. Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, says there is broad support for Medicaid reform.
There's no need to keep the pressure up. The governor understands, Democrats understand, Republicans understand, but we need to find ways to save money.
Nearly 1,000 Alaskans have enrolled in Medicaid expansion since the state began accepting applications at the beginning of the month. But about half of those enrollees transferred to Medicaid from a state program that paid for health care for very low-income residents with chronic or terminal medical conditions. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Every year, 133 billion pounds of food end up in landfills in the United States. That's 31% of the country's food supply. To curb that, today the federal government announced its first ever food waste reduction goals. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced they aim to reduce waste by 50% by 2030. But some stores in Alaska are already doing what they can to reduce their waste and feed hungry Alaskans. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman took a tour of Fred Meyer in southeast Anchorage.
Fred Meyer store director Stephen Longnecker strides through the store, greeting everyone he sees.
Hector, how are you?
All right, how's it going?
What's the countdown to vacation?
He knows the names of all 289 of his coworkers. He also knows what's going to sell in his grocery store and what's not.
In our business, you know, back to school season, overnight, with the flip of the switch, you may go from selling one unit of pint-sized milk to 100 units of pint-sized milk in a day.
Longnecker steps into the massive dairy refrigerator and slips into back office business speak. They have sales histories and metrics and data that help him order the right amount of each product for each season. But the calculations aren't perfect. Sometimes cranberry sauce just isn't popular that year, or they'll have one or two extras of something. And sometimes a pallet full of bananas is still good enough to eat, but not pretty enough to sell.
That banana's traveled a long way by the time that it gets to Alaska, and at times you will find some product that you need to, that we're not going to be able to sell our way out of.
So instead, it's donated to the food bank. Last year, Anchorage Fred Meyer stores donated 283,000 pounds. Longnecker says they started donating the perishable food instead of throwing it away about 5 years ago. Since then, Kroger, the company that owns Fred Meyer, has reduced their costs for disposing of waste by 70% nationwide.
And that's pretty revolutionary for all of us because it cut the cost of expenses in a big way, and it also really benefits our communities.
In 2014, Alaska's food industry donated nearly 4.9 million pounds of food to the food bank. 27% of that was produce. That's a big change from 9 years ago, when the food bank couldn't offer individual families much in the way of fresh fruits and veggies. Food bank development director Carla Jutzi says that's what people want to buy to stay healthy, but they can't afford it.
People in need tell us that they know they are buying high-calorie, highly processed food that's not very good for them, but they can get more of that for their dollar than they can get of healthy fresh food. And so that's why having fresh produce and other fresh food available from our food industry partners makes a huge difference for folks who can't afford it themselves.
Jutzi says now even community gardeners are bringing in fresh produce. It's distributed through the mobile food pantries. She says they do receive some donations that are too far gone to give to people, so they try to give as much as possible to local pig farmers. Back at Fred Meyer, Longnecker says they do have to throw away some unsafe foods. A composting system is still a few years away. We head past the towering shelves of goods in the storage area and back into the main store.
All right, Ann, so we need a hairnet before we go into our meat department.
Fair enough.
Food manager and former butcher Anthony Gurley slices into a stack of short ribs. He starts trimming the sides of the meat. Bits of red flesh are tossed into a pile to be ground into burgers. The rubbery white fat is set aside in a box. In the lower 48, it's sold to companies that render it into makeup and other goods. In Anchorage,
we will sell all of this right here to a lot of hunters in hunting season.
He says hunters add it to ground moose and caribou to help make sausage and burgers.
And we do our best to get as streamlined as best we can and keep it as minimal waste as possible. I mean, there's no point in it. Somebody will buy something. They'll all buy something.
With that, he lines up the ribs on a white styrofoam tray, ready to pack them up and put them on the sales floor. If they don't sell, they'll be refrozen and put aside to be donated to the food bank. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Alaska Department of Education is looking for 3 experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. These school improvement coaches would work as contractors to the state. Apply by September 15th. Call 907-465-8721 or inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority will select a partner for the Interior Energy Project by the end of the year. ADA chose finalists earlier this month following a request for proposed plans to supply Fairbanks with natural gas this summer. An earlier public-private partnership yielded a North Slope gas plan that proved to be too expensive. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a review committee will consider the latest proposals and how state financing can be used to leverage a project.
2 of the 5 finalist companies, Harvest Alaska and Salix, have offered Cook Inlet gas supplies, while Westpac Midstream proposes tapping either Cook Inlet or imported Canadian gas. 2 others, Phoenix Clean Fuels and Spectrum LNG, are offering North Slope gas supplies. ADA Energy Infrastructure Development Officer Nick Schmoniak says all 5 companies can technically get the job done, and the issue is finances.
Make sure that, yeah, the costs of proposing are reasonable. They are backed up. They are achievable.
Natural gas has long been sought by interior residents as a lower-cost, cleaner-burning alternative to oil, coal, and wood. But gas requires distribution lines and conversion of heating and power generation systems, elements that undermine potential demand and have inhibited private sector interest in the project. The state legislature allocated over $330 million in financing aimed at lessening the risk of investing in an expensive gas processing plant and other infrastructure. ADA's Schmoniak says the challenge is using the financing to enable a gas supply that works for private industry, local utilities, and consumers.
Cover the costs in the early years when there's not the volumes flowing through the plant to make it cash flow on its own without hitting the consumers with a high price.
The 5 finalist companies being considered as partners for the Interior Energy Project have been charged with fine-tuning their proposals by October 16th. A committee which includes representatives of local utilities will then analyze the proposals and select a partner by December 17th. Schmoniak says it's possible ADA could partner with more than one company. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The MV Susitna is one step closer to being sold. According to Matanuska Susitna Borough Manager John Moosey, progress has been made on a deal to sell the vessel to the Philippine Red Cross. The agreement with the Red Cross hinges on insurance company involvement because 3 of the ferry's 4 engines have been damaged by rainwater, rendering the ship inoperable.
We actually have a signed agreement with the Philippine Red Cross. Just this morning, they transferred the $250,000, so we can begin repairs on the 3 engines. What we are waiting, however, on is to get an understanding on the level of repair from our insurance company and make sure the Philippine Red Cross is agreeable to that.
The agreement between the borough and the Philippine Red Cross hinges on the borough repairing the engine damage as a condition of sale. If all goes as planned, the Red Cross will make a down payment of $750,000, or half the purchase price, and upon completion of successful repairs and on an export permit, the Red Cross will fund the remaining $750,000. The unused ferry, which has been stored in a Ketchikan shipyard, has cost the borough around $2 million in storage and insurance fees over the past 3 years. The biggest cruise ship ever to visit the Aleutian Islands pulled into Dutch Harbor in Unalaska on Tuesday. The Floating City disgorged 2,500 passengers and 1,000 crew. As KUCB's John Ryan reports, the population of Unalaska nearly doubled for the day.
For many towns in southern Alaska, the arrival of a mega cruise ship would make for an ordinary or even a slow day for tourism. Juneau can handle 5 big cruise ships at once. But those towns along the main cruise corridors have infrastructure for a deluge of wandering pedestrians, and Alaska does not. Passengers walk down the ramp from the Celebrity Millennium onto an industrial dock. The floating city's PA system blared safety messages at its passengers. They learned, as they prepared to walk off the ship for the first time in 3 days, that Dutch Harbor isn't really set up for pedestrians, let alone large numbers of them.
When leaving the dock and heading away from the airport, there is no paved walking area. Please be very mindful of industrial traffic.
A small number of passengers started a long and windy walk into the center of town, despite the lack of sidewalks. Many more hopped on board the buses, taxis, and rental cars lined up at the dock. Fire Chief Zach Chasteen said there weren't any problems with tourists wandering into the wrong areas of the nation's busiest commercial fishing port. The arrival of the supersized ship sent town officials and many volunteers into a flurry of activity.
We've done the best we can. We've kind of been sounding the alarm, so to speak, for at least a year.
Kathy Jordan runs the Unalaska Visitors Bureau. She says despite the overwhelming number of visitors, the day went smoothly.
I am just thrilled with the outpouring of support from the community.
A few hundred of the passengers showed up at a crafts market set up inside the town gym. One local artist said she sold enough postcards and jewelry to be worth her effort, but it wasn't a huge boost to her business. Across the street, the school district made 10 bucks a head for a program of traditional Unungan culture.
What I'm wearing is feels like wax paper, but this is the intestine of a walrus.
Unalaska's physical and electronic infrastructure wasn't built to handle many hundreds of tourists showing up at once. The Millennium started in Vancouver and is headed to China. Unlike Unalaska, the giant ship has its own movie theater, a spa, and an internet cafe. Unalaska officials asked the ship to have its passengers put their phones in airplane mode while they're here. Otherwise, they might overwhelm Unalaska's phone system. Passenger Bob Kanabi from Saskatchewan says word did trickle down to the passengers.
What status are your phones on right now, if I may ask?
I don't have a phone.
Oh, yes, I do.
I don't.
Well, here we go. I'll show you. Airplane mode.
Other passengers could be seen walking down the street, staring at their phones. Parts of town had internet outages in the afternoon, but it's hard to know if that's because of the large number of tourists or just another day in Unalaska. A warming Arctic could lead to more ships passing through the Aleutians for business and pleasure. If so, Unalaska will face choices about what kinds of ships it wants to welcome and whether to embrace industrial-scale tourism as well as industrial-scale fishing. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and John Ryan in Unalaska. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.